If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
Generally speaking, the population, not all of them are out to do malice or they have ill intent. They just want to serve their time and go home. And that's really the majority of it. The stuff you see on the news and the TVs, that's the two percenters, right? The majority of these individuals know that they did something wrong. They want to serve their time and they want to go back into society. We as a society have to start accepting that not everybody in there is rapists and murderers. Some just got caught with something. You know, petty theft. Okay, doing 6 months. That's where I would like our industry and the public to start opening our minds up to, is just because they're in jail or in prison doesn't make them a bad person. They just made a bad choice.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Craig Armstrong, partner at Elevatus Architecture in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Craig provides executive leadership and full accountability for the vision, performance, and contractual success of large multi-phase architectural projects. A senior leader and integral member of the firm for more than a decade, he guides complex projects from strategy through construction with rigorous documentation, disciplined execution, and unwavering accountability. His expertise across core markets, particularly justice and retail/hospitality, position him as a trusted advisor who ensures design excellence, operational continuity, and successful delivery. The project we're talking about today, a first for the show, is the Westville State Prison in Westville, Indiana. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Rising just south of the existing facility, the new Westville State Prison marks a clean break from a campus that had simply run out of time. By the time the state evaluated it, the buildings could no longer meet basic standards for safety or performance, and saving them no longer made sense. The decision to build new, rather than continue to retrofit, set the tone for everything that followed.
It is a correctional campus in the fact that there's multiple buildings serving all different uses. We are replacing a facility that in some parts were built back in the Civil War era. It's just a tired and run-down facility. It's a prison, so it obviously gets a lot of abuse. So the scope of this project is 4,208 beds. We do 4,200 because, you know, rounding it down. It consists of 27 construction document buildings that has been under construction since July of 23, and it will not complete until end of this year at the earliest. And that doesn't include some of the renovation buildings we have inside. You're like, okay, what's 4,200 beds and 27 buildings look like from a square footage standpoint? We're about 1.5 million square feet of floor area for across the whole campus. So that's monstrous. It is massive. The good news is it's immediately south. So the future occupants of this building can see it come up, and they're starting to get, well, as excited as an incarcerated individual can be, right? But the staff is also really excited because there's a lot of things that this design takes into account that will make their jobs a little bit easier and safer.
Does that mean you did 27 different construction document packages?
Yes, it does.
Oh, as a spec writer, that almost gives me hives.
To clarify, yes, we did 27 sets of construction documents, but because the deliverable method was a GMP CMR, so construction manager at risk, we were able to utilize a singular specification for the entire campus. And we would just utilize a master table of contents that would basically populate which sections apply to which buildings so that the CM could then package the bid scopes with those specs that we selected on table of contents. So a little peek behind the curtain there and how we manage the specifications for 27 construction documents.
Programmatically, the campus expands far beyond basic containment, spanning approximately 1.4 million square feet across 28 buildings. The new campus operates as a highly coordinated network rather than a monolithic structure.
When you're doing something of this scale and this size, you have to do it in pieces, right? I mean, that's kind of obvious. So who you bring into the room, who you talk about, you know, who goes first, what happens first is really a fluid situation. You know, I think everybody will agree that nobody knows how to use their building, whether it be a school, a recreation center, a hospital, better than the people who operate it, right? That's no secret. I mean, you want to talk to the mechanical engineer, the mechanical and the maintenance crew about some of the MEP systems, because they're the ones who are going to have to deal with it. When we're done and out of the way, they have to deal with what we give them. So really just keeping those things at the forefront of your mind, it's not all that different from any other building in terms of those aspects. Yeah, there's a whole different level from the incarcerated individual side and the safety and security aspect, but the overall process is relatively the same. It's just volume and time.
The design directly reflects the needs of incarcerated individuals and considers all aspects of physical and mental health.
What happens when an incarcerated individual has a cold, needs medical attention, has a dental problem, has, you know, a broken arm or something because they got into a tuffle or somebody? Like, how do you take an incarcerated individual to the hospital? Not easily, right? I mean, you're talking about closing the hospital down, an entire floor or something like that. So understanding that the clientele who are in here, they still are human beings. They just made a bad choice in a lot of times. They just made a bad choice. Now, some of them can be pretty bad people, but most of them are not. They're human beings. And, you know, getting medical attention, you know, getting some support, getting some training so that you can keep the recidivism down. Those are all things that you want to take into consideration, no matter if it's a, you know, small jail or a prison campus. What does the outside impact look like? The other thing that's kind of, you know, challenging with these types of facilities is, unlike an office building in a school, those buildings are only populated 8 to 12 hours a day. These correctional facilities, jails, prisons, whatever you want to call them, they're 24/7, 365. So you can imagine that the age of this building, yeah, it might only be 150 years old, but in reality, it's much older because it's gone through that constant abuse.
While the project scale adds complexity to the permitting process, established state regulations for correctional facilities provide a clear framework, allowing approvals to proceed in a structured, phased manner.
The advantage of a state prison is they really only have to comply with the state statutes. Like, the local jurisdictions really don't have much control over what you do or don't do from a state-owned facility. Now, that's Indiana. Other states are a little bit different. But there was still a process that we followed. We still had to submit to get our construction design release, which is what they call it here in Indiana. And we had a meeting with the entire plan reviewers for the state before we even got to the point of submitting, letting them know, hey, this is coming. You know, here's what we're thinking. What are you thinking? Just because of the sheer size and scale of it all, right? Because they were going to get all this stuff. I'm like, holy cow. And the nice thing about, you know, the way that we delivered this and the way we had to bid it out was that we didn't have to submit all 27 buildings at the same time. We phased it because there is no way, and I'm not giving away anything with this statement, when you have 1.4 million square feet of buildings and you're in a small town like Westville, Indiana, which is a suburb of Alpo, you're not going to get a whole lot of contractors to bid on this right away, and especially from a bonding capacity. I don't know how anybody could bond $1 billion worth of work. Maybe there's some players out there, but that'd be hard to do. So dealing with the state plan reviewers and the permitting process went relatively smoothly because we had those strategy sessions up front. I think I just got my final release for the last building maybe a year ago, and we were always have those things in hand before they started. It's an institutional 3 occupancy primarily, which is specific for jails and corrections. You know, it offers a whole lot of different opportunities for egress, let's say. Normally when there's a fire in the building, you run to the stairwell, you go down with panic bars, and you just get out of the building whenever you want. You really cannot do that in a correctional facility. So there's aspects of the code you got to take into account. There's some other nuances about that as well. The staff in some positions that they hold, they have to be able-bodied. So those things are stuff that we consider. Yeah, those are the things we're kind of had to think through pretty carefully. We had to think through that.
The site's wide open field offered the perfect opportunity to accommodate the project's 27 structures, but the infrastructure system was robust and required strategic placement.
The site that we had is one of the more favorable sites that, you know, you just dream of. It was a big old corn farm field. It was all farmland, relatively flat, not a whole lot of grade. All the soil borings and everything that we did indicated that these were sandy soils, not the traditional clay that you see in a lot of areas in Indiana. So we were really given a pretty phenomenal site in that sense. Between the new and the existing, it's 176 acres. I think the new is like 80-some acres. And you're like, okay, that should be plenty of space for 27 buildings. We actually had to demo a couple of the older buildings on the south campus to get some of our new buildings in. Just because of the way that, you know, the client wanted the design and the flow of things, we did find ourselves at times saying, man, if I only had a little bit more space, because I got a county road to the south, I got a county road to the west, and I got a railroad track easement to the east. Now, the railroad's been abandoned forever. But yeah, we were kind of landlocked in that sense. And we're like, oh, we'll be fine. We get pretty close to the property lines on a couple of these because of the way that the facility needed to function for the end user. Now, good news is we got it all in. You know, one of the more interesting things was, you know, the underground and the storm water management and, you know, how you get all of the things that are needed to operate a building to the buildings. Water, fire, domestic, you got electrical, you got telecommunications. There is a whole lot of things we had to do there. We had to have a utility company come out and put in their entire, you know, telephone poles and their entire substation, just because of the scale that we're talking about. I got 4 huge boilers and 4 very large generators that could seriously populate a small town. I mean, it's got 4,208 occupants plus staff. That's a good small town when you think about it in terms of occupation.
Since you have been constructing this in phases, some of that infrastructure that you have to build for a site like this, I'm guessing you're not deciding that in phases. I mean, I would think you had to have a pretty solid master plan, even if a particular building wasn't fully designed yet. at least footprint in what that building was going to need for all that infrastructure, piping and electricity and HVAC, and then you weren't going to be able to stray from that.
No.
Because didn't that all have to go in at once?
We had to put all that in, and we had to put it in a location that didn't interfere with the construction of the buildings. So now you're saying, okay, well, where could that have been? Of course, it's the perimeter of the site, so we call it the loop. And the loop has got a four-pipe hydronic system, fiber optic, electrical, and you got to build in some redundancy. So, you know, we've got, you know, backup generators to power the whole campus. If the town of Westville loses power and this facility goes offline, this facility cannot afford to not be without power, which is why we have all the generators. So, yes, we had to really think about, you know, the stormwater, how we're going to get that around. That's also in the perimeter, some retention ponds. Sorry, detention ponds that we've got in here. And the water kind of does a 180. So it starts in the northeast and we kind of flow it all the way around and head about northwest because, you know, the regulation says you got to keep all your runoff within your boundary. So that's kind of how we had to do it. But yeah, the buildings and the site, the buildings could be done in phases. The site could not. So you're right in that sense.
Precast concrete enabled flexibility and enforced the envelope needed for the variety of spaces across the facility. Dedicated facilities for vocational training and industrial manufacturing positions work as a core component of daily life, while educational and recreational spaces introduce rhythms that more closely resemble those of a small, self-contained community.
You know, when you're doing something of this size, you want to look for materials that are, you know, economical and scalable. There's only a couple of products out there that, you know, can do that, you know, precast being one of them. You can cast a whole bunch of those very easily and erect these buildings very quickly, relatively quickly. I think at the peak out here, when they were building all of these buildings, there were like five cranes that were all constructing precast wall panels and roof planks and all that stuff. But it was short durations than it would be a traditional, you know, stick-built building. So that's kind of how we were able to keep things going from a materiality standpoint and what the exterior skin is. Because can you imagine a bricklayer or finding enough masons to lay up this stuff? That I don't think there's enough manpower in the entire state of Indiana that could do that in the time frame that we needed it to be in, because time is money, right? As with any facility, not every incarcerated individual is the same level of person who's committed the same heinous act as others. So you've got, you know, the worst of the worst that will have to go to restrictive housing. And you've got low-level incarcerated individuals that go to minimum security housing. And you got everybody in between. You know, the level of classifications you got to worry about, you know, okay, is this person this and that? From an operations standpoint, it really is interesting how they evaluate, you know, the incarcerated individuals that come in. It's like, okay, can I put this person in the same day room as this person? The answer may be yes or no, depending on what type of crime they may or may not have committed. So the fact that we've got everything from restrictive housing all the way down to minimum security, it's hard to pick just one. But you got a protective custody unit that's got to be here because there are certain individuals who need that total protection, because word gets out that, I'll just use a rough example, you know, a child molester, they oftentimes need protective custody because of an incarcerated individual in there who's got a daughter. Can you only imagine what can happen with that? So from an intake standpoint, they really have to look at this, and we've got to give them spaces to react to those. And of course, I mentioned the medical component earlier, and of course, you know, a kitchen, you got to feed everybody three times a day. You know, what does that look like? Gym recreation buildings, vocational, because you want to reduce recidivism. We have a mental health building component. But the one thing I'm getting at with all of this is, and I think any correctional facility would have the same mindset as any correctional designer. We want to reduce recidivism. We don't want the incarcerated individuals that when they're done with their time to come back in, and giving them things so they can reintegrate with society is important. It's why you're seeing a lot of things pop up like community corrections and those types of things that kind of help with those halfway house ideas. So some of the philosophies that the state wanted to take about, hey, I don't want them to come back, what does that look like? That kind of altered and impacted, you know, some of the design solutions you put together. So that concept is what I value and what I thought is most interesting about the whole campus.
Energy performance, window placement, and the consideration of openings within the envelope required careful coordination. Balancing access to daylight and well-being for occupants with the strict security demands of the facility.
We designed it to all the energy codes. And one of the things that you, when you talk about, is anytime that you put an opening in a security barrier, that is a potential breach point. So, and as you can imagine, in a correctional facility, I just can't put a Conair 451, you know, UT system in and call it good. No, that's something that can be breached and taken out with, you know, certain abuse. So now you got to look at things like specific window manufacturer that's got thermal things in it. That's also rated for a level of attack from an incarcerated individual. So you got to keep them secure. So those are the things that we had to look at when it comes to the envelope is, yes, we want to make sure that this is an energy efficient building because that'll keep your air handlers down and all of that. But anytime you put an opening in the penetration, you've got to look at it from the incarcerated individual side. It's like, that to me is an opportunity for escape. And there are things that we as correctional designers do to kind of mitigate those. The one of them is you select the right windows system and that'll get there. You know, putting security bars on could be another way to do it. So those are the types of things that I would encourage, you know, correctional designers to look into, is really look at what products you're selecting, and don't forget about the potential breach point, because that's exactly what the incarcerated individuals are looking to do. In terms of the requirements, there weren't any other than, hey, do what you can to keep our utility costs down, because our old buildings are so inefficient and they leak. No matter what we did here, we were going to come out ahead, because like I said earlier in the cast, you know, there are parts of that existing facility that were built in the Civil War. Well, there was no such thing as an energy code back in the mid-1800s.
MEP systems similarly required scrutiny in placement and design to maximize functionality, safety, and abundance.
You've got to account for it running the whole time. And, you know, you might pick a more expensive system that has a little bit more robust parts so you can maintain the longevity that you need. And to one of the things you hit on in terms of, you know, people crawling in and out of things, like we've all seen Die Hard. Nobody really crawls through ductwork, but there are security measures that we have to take that will impact the design of a system, and the toilets are steel, and, you know, how do you fasten those to the walls? Because the one thing that we all have to remember about incarcerated individuals, that one thing that they have an abundance of is time. All they have is time. And when you give somebody time and isolation, they can really come up with some really ingenious and creative things. For example, I have in my possession something where they took two seasoning containers and a broken set of headphones, because they're given those sometimes, some speaker wire, and they converted those to a headphone with some shoestring and everything. Like, it was a makeshift headphone out of nothing but seasoning containers, old speakers, and shoelaces. That is pretty creative. So we don't want incarcerated individuals to take the easy way out, so to speak, right? So you gotta take those things into account. Like, you never thought that a grab bar for an accessibility stall would need an anti-ligature component to it. Yeah, we put bottom plates on there, and that's standard in the correctional industry so that they can't harm themselves on it. So can you imagine water usage alone? Just water usage.
How many inmates approximately?
4,208 potentially. So you imagine them, you know, all of them brushing their teeth twice a day, all of them using the restroom 5-6 times a day, all of them showering once a day, every other day, drinking water, coffee, anything. Yeah, it's a incredible amount. And, you know, there are measures that correctional facilities put in place, and anybody who does these knows these things. You manage the water. if you got somebody in there who's just having a really bad day and he just wants to, you know, keep hitting the flush toilet thing 100 times, there are ways to deactivate those things so that you don't have wasteful water. There's economizer systems. There are light sensors. So, you know, with the level of daylighting we've got coming in, will the light shut off? Sure. It's not so much a problem anymore with LEDs, but with all the LED fixtures, it's just volume. And when you have that much volume, it does equate to cost. So yeah, all the innovation systems that you use in an office building, we do adapt and try to put them in some form into a correctional facility.
Equally transformative is the attention given to staff environments. Historically underserved in correctional design, administrative and support spaces here are reconceived to include amenities that acknowledge the demands placed on those who operate the facility.
What are the most vulnerable positions that either the incarcerated individual or the staff member could be? When you think about any correctional facility, it doesn't care, doesn't matter who you are. It's when you have to move an incarcerated individual from point A to point B. And it has to be a controlled movement. If I'm going from one zone into another, you do things that are called sally ports. So you got to make sure the door is shut behind you before you can open the door in front of you so that nobody tries to, you know, duck out real quick or come in for an extra meal if they come in the exit door. There are certain things that you've got to worry about when it comes to movement and interlocking doors and, you know, having a very good operating procedure in place that the staff knows, memorizes, and can execute. If you get those things right, you're going to do a lot of good things. I think it's also, you know, as a reaction to an incarcerated individual movement, how often are you moving them? So start thinking about that. You know, if you're in a COVID situation, what does that look like? These are the questions that we as designers now have to start asking ourselves is, okay, it's not just about the incarcerated individuals and keeping them in. It's also about the safety and the security of the staff. You want the staff to feel safe and supported by the spaces that we give them. And there, it's a very, very stressful job. And you can imagine it's probably not overly glamorous either. But those individuals are still people trying to make a living. So think about their safety as much as keeping them in, keeping the incarcerated individuals in. Think about their needs because they're people as well. You've got an observation post, usually on an elevated platform, overlooking the entire day room, just monitoring what's going on. And then depending on what situation you're in, there are custody staff that's roaming in the day rooms. They have stations that they can park at. You know, be mindful of where you're putting those and really start thinking about how many incarcerated individuals do you want in a specific area to the quantity of staff. That's important. But generally speaking, the population, not all of them are out to do malice or they have ill intent. They just want to serve their time and go home. And that's really the majority of it. The stuff you see on the news and the TVs, that's the 2%ers, right? The majority of these individuals know that they did something wrong. They want to serve their time and they want to go back into society. We as a society have to start accepting that not everybody in there is rapists and murderers. Some just got caught with something. You know, petty theft. Okay, doing 6 months. That's where I would like our industry and the public to start opening our minds up to is just because they're in jail or in prison doesn't make them a bad person. They just made a bad choice.
Grasping all risks associated with a correctional facility, whether safety or medical-based, can weigh heavily on the design process.
Anytime that you're putting a medical component like dentist chairs and medical head walls and stuff into a campus facility, that can be very tricky. Barber, like they need haircuts. Well, scissors, really? those are the type of things that gave me a little hesitation when I was early on. And then it's like, you know, if you got a good operating procedure and you've got, you know, the custody staff in there, it's really not an issue. Just check the tools, like kitchens. I mean, you're cooking, you're frying, you've got, you know, incarcerated individual workers in there helping. Okay, what are we doing? Do we give them knives or not? It's like, well, sure. They're usually the low offenders. They just want to cook. They want to do something. So it's a very difficult question to answer, because a lot of things on a correctional facility keep me up at night. But I would say the medical component is probably the one that's, did we get that right? You know, are we going to have a problem? Are we going to have an addiction issue on our hands? And it really comes down to the operations of the facility.
At about $1.2 billion and a timeline of 5 to 6 years, the project is one of the largest correctional builds in the country and the first new prison in Indiana in more than 20 years. The construction phase will necessitate several teams to coordinate and meet project deadlines.
From a construction side, one thing that I observed, I didn't have to deal with it, that was probably a huge opportunity for the construction manager, was receiving materials and coordinating the movement of these things. I mean, you can imagine, you know, I mentioned precast earlier. You know, a truck comes in, you pick it off, that truck leaves, the next truck's in right behind it. Scheduling that alone was, there's a lot of good things. There's a lot of opportunity. Ones that, you know, we kind of deal with on the design side with the construction is trying to bridge the gap between different contractors. You know, I'm coming up to this point with this thing. Okay, I'm coming out to this point. Okay, do those things line up? Do they connect? Does everybody have everything from point A to point B? You know, and where does it make sense? You know, does the guys installing the site, do they need to come in with their piping and stub up through the floor? Well, the building's not there, so how do you get that happening? Well, the building guys are like, well, I can come out, but I don't have the site piping there. So, you know, we've had some challenges, opportunities to get those pipes to match up, and trying to be part and offer them ways to fix it. Like, okay, you can do some soft bends because of the type of pipe we're using. Trying to guide them and resolve it through those types of issues are some of the stuff that we deal with. It's actually a joint venture between three contractor firms for the construction manager. And then they have six teams that manage specific projects. Some are managing multiple, some are managing just one. It depends on how many buildings and what they are. And then underneath that, you've got the whole contractor team. At the peak of this campus, which will be this summer, they're estimating somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000 workers on site at the same time, all working on some aspect of the construction. Quality assurance, quality control, you know, is this contractor doing it the same way on this building as they're doing it over there? By the way, I got contractor A, who's mechanical on this building, contractor B, who's mechanical on that building. They want to try to use different things. It's like, no, you can't, because from a maintenance standpoint, I'm not going to stock 50 different ball valves. and it's a challenge when you're doing public work, because you've got to have open bid, open spec. So luckily, we were able to do that. We got a lot of contractors across multiple buildings, but there are some where, you know, contractor B and contractor A are different, and they have slightly different philosophies of installations, but it's okay. We got them there. And yeah, there'll be some multiple different styles of valves or anything that we've got stored. Yeah, there'll be some of that, but we did try to mitigate that as much as we could.
For Craig, this project revealed several contemplative lessons and moments of reflection to better inform future designs of this magnitude.
Don't make assumptions. Don't rush to conclusions. Try to understand why the question's being asked. So I would say the lessons that I'm learning on this is patience, and make sure that I'm taking a step back and understanding the whole picture. It's easy to have the blinders on, right? And what this project has afforded me is a whole different way of approach and philosophy on how to manage construction. It's like, okay, I see you know, this is in the wrong spot, but let's figure out how we got there. And the lessons learned that we have on this project is massive. And it's been a pretty smooth project considering. It's just volume. But there's a lot of things that we would do differently. I'm sure the contractors would do differently. Even the owners in some respects would probably do a little bit differently. So yeah, being more open-minded and patience are the two things that I will take into my next job. Yeah, the skills and the corrections, and those are all good things too. As designers and architects, we can get a little possessive over our stuff. And I'm going to work better to break that mold and try to come at it from multiple perspectives and look for new innovative ideas. Because just because it's Craig's way doesn't mean it's the only way.
The Westfield State Prison reframes the old facility as a place of structured transition rather than static confinement. Through its architectural clarity, programmatic depth, and emphasis on human dignity, Westfield positions itself at the intersection of infrastructure and reform, an environment designed not only to house, but to transform. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what advice Craig would offer to someone thinking of taking on a unique and specialized project type like this to help them start off on the right foot.
Own it. Really embrace the opportunity. Look at it from a lens of, it's not flashy design, it's what does the client want? I mean, remember, architecture is a professional service that we provide. We provide a service. Architects are one of the few professions that touches every human being that exists. Somebody will walk into a building at some point. A doctor. Somebody will see a doctor at some point, even if it's only at birth. So don't think that, you know, design is everything. There are meaningful things that we as design professionals can do that will enhance the public. And of course, our mission as architects is protect the health, safety, and welfare of all the occupants of our buildings. It's not saying we can't do good design. I think there are a million opportunities of design. And if something is not overly glamorous, take one little piece of it and make that a design. Own it. That would be my advice. Don't think that you have to be flashy designers. Keep in mind that we are a service to clients, and we are a provider of a building that makes the people feel safe and comfortable. And if we have opportunities to show off great design, bravo, let's do it.
I truly enjoyed this conversation with Craig. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I try to go through life with a good heart and what can I do to relieve some of the burden of you. I don't necessarily need to live a legacy. I don't need a monument named after Craig Armstrong. I don't need that. If I impact one person, just one person, and I make a meaningful change to their life that enhances their experience on this earth, that is why I do what I do. And incarcerated individuals deserve that just the same as, you know, Charisse or myself. Everybody deserves to feel appreciated and as somebody of worth, because we are all worth something. And if I can do something to enhance that, I'm a pretty happy guy.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. visit arcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.